I should be on now.
Yay. I have to turn this one on.
And I'm on for Marion, right?
Okay.
So the passage that we're going to be looking at is Mark 14, 12 through 31. I think most of you will find this to be a very familiar passage. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb was sacrificed, the disciples said to Jesus, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover meal?" He sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city. A man carrying a water jar will meet you. Follow him. Wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room where I can eat the Passover meal with my disciples?' He will show you a large room upstairs already furnished. Prepare for us there." The disciples left, came into the city, found everything just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover meal. That evening, Jesus arrived with the 12. During the meal, Jesus said, "I assure you that one of you will betray me," someone eating with me. Deeply saddened, they asked him one by one, "It's not me, is it?" Jesus answered, "It's one of the 12, one who is dipping bread with me into this bowl. The human one goes to his death, just as is written, 'You'll have the Son of Man,' but really means human being. The human being goes to his death, just as it is written about him. But how terrible it is for that person who betrays the human being. It would have been better for him if he had never been born." While they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to them and said, Take, this is my body." He took a cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, and they all drank from it. Then he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. I assure you that I won't drink wine again until that day when I drink it in a new way in God's kingdom." After singing songs of praise, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Jesus said to them, "You will all falter in your faithfulness to me. It is written, 'I will hit the shepherd and the sheep will go off in all directions.' But after I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even if all these guys stumble, I won't." But Jesus said to them, "I assure you that on this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But Peter insisted, "If I must die alongside you, I won't deny you." And they all said the same thing. So the title of my sermon is Yeast, Feast, and Betrayal. And one of these things is not like the other. And I've tried so hard to find a word for betrayal that rhymed with yeast and feast. I mean, I had my thesaurus out. I was Googling. So surely there's a word. Or maybe I could change yeast and feast to something else. But finally, I realized my problem. And that is betrayal has nothing in common with yeast and feast. Nothing in common. And that's kind of why what I want to really bring out, one of the things I want to bring out today. So something I try to do every time I preach and teach is to explain the background of the passage. That is, I look at passages in the Bible and say, well, this is written in a different language. It was written to an entirely different culture, a different kind of people. And so we are going to miss a lot of things in the passage if you don't know the background. And that's my real focus today. I'm going to explain some things about the background. And some of that seem a little random to you, but I think it's going to come, hopefully it comes together in the end. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on one point that you'll say, what is this about? But I hope you'll get me. And that is actually, I'm focusing on the Feast of Unleavened Bread, just as a point to start with. Unleavened bread. Unleavened bread is bread without yeast. And so the Jews had a feast of unleavened bread. We call it Passover. They called it Passover. They called the meal celebrated a Seder, but the Feast of Unleavened Bread was a whole week. For a whole week, they ate bread without yeast. So first, I think to really actually get what's going on here, you have to understand something about yeast and something about how yeast worked in the old days. Now, yeast is an interesting thing. Most of the bread you eat is probably made with yeast, almost all of it. With some, even crackers will have yeast in them. It's the thing that puts the holes in the bread and the lift in the crackers, right? And there was a time, and this is really hard to get, but most people didn't buy their bread at a store. They made their own bread. And some of you might actually know how to do that. You say, I know how to make bread. I've got a bread maker, right? Well, you go and you buy your envelopes or jars of yeast, and then you measure it out and you mix it with warm water to activate it. But here's a kicker. There was a time when you couldn't buy yeast. Can you believe that? Louis Pasteur discovered fermentation in 1857, and the Fleischmann brothers started marketing it in North America in 1860. So before 1860, you couldn't go to the store and buy yeast. What did they do? What did you do? Because I assure you, people were eating bread with yeast before history, before they even knew how to write. They were using yeast. Well, people grew their own wild yeast. And here's how they did it. They just mixed a little flour and water and left it out. We know all about this. I will get into that. At room temperature. And like magic, in 2 or 3 days, it would start to change. It would get smell a little differently and get a lift to it. And what makes it change? Can you handle the truth? Okay. When I talk to people about, I've been talking about this to people lately, and they look at me straight on and say, what makes it grow? You know, there's just water and flour, and I'm like, it's mold. It's that everywhere in the world, there's mold in the air. And so when you leave flour and water mixed together, you've got to knead it a bit to make this work. It's going to absorb the mold out of the air. I didn't mean to talk a great deal about this, but I actually know that this is one of the things that makes homegrown yeast a very healthy thing. I just read a list that said, here are the things that people eat who live the longest, and one of them was sourdough bread, which is bread made with wild yeast. It said, because I think that it's absorbing things from the environment, it's kind of like taking an inoculation, and that you're absorbing things that help keep you from getting sick because you're actually eating mold. Okay, I don't know if you all followed that, but it's true. So next thing you do, is you can't. It's not good in 3 days. You've got to add a little more flour and water, and then it takes 1 or 2 days, and it starts bubbling. Then you add some more flour and water, and in 8 hours, you wouldn't believe what it looks like. It looks like a boiling pot, kind of frozen. You can see bubbles coming up, you know, and say, this is like magic, you know, how does this even happen? It's amazing. And now you have a starter. Now you have a starter for bread. And so you take about a little bit aside, and you mix the rest with your bread ingredients. But you have to feed your starter more and more flour and water to keep it alive, because it is alive, right? Now it's a live thing. So when you want to bake bread, even if you even have a starter and you've gone through this process, it could take as long as a week, you have to plan ahead. And ideally, the night before you make bread, you take a cup of starter and you mix it with 2.5 cups of flour and 2 cups of water and you leave it out. When you get up in the morning, the mixture's gone crazy. I mean, it's so weird. And I say to Glenn, look at this! You know, look at this thing! He's not quite as interested as I am in it. I don't know. Then you mix in your bread ingredients. Well, first of all, you have to take out the starter and some of the starter and put it back again so you have starter for next time. Then you mix your bread ingredients. You knead it for 5 or so minutes. And then you let it rise for 2 hours or so. Punch it down. Let it rest for 30 minutes. And then punch it down again and form it into loaves. Then you let it rest for 1.5 or 2 hours again. And then you get to, you better remember, you know, bake your oven and have your stone to put your bread on and all that stuff. And you put it in the oven for an hour. Well, just that took 13 to 17 hours. 13 to 17 hours to have a loaf or two of bread. And you know, in the old days, a lot of households went through a loaf or two of bread a day or more. So this was a daily routine that most women did up until 1860. Most women did this. So, well, and just a little bit to make this, to bring this home, on December 19th, my son-in-law wrote me and said, could you bring some sourdough starter with you when you come for Christmas? I'm like going, oh, he thinks I have sourdough starter. He thinks I'm doing this thing. And so I wrote actually on the WBC community website, I said, I have a prayer request that I might find a sourdough starter in the next 2 days. And James answered and said, ooh, me too, I'm missing sourdough. Roxanne Green, do you have any? And Roxanne says, sorry, I let mine die. I think that was what it was. And so on January 6th, though, after I went, I went with no starter, sad day. And we ran around Boston, tried to find some starter, and it just didn't happen. And so on January 6th, though, I came back to church, and James chased me down, and he handed me a starter. And he had gone through this long process of growing his own. This whole process I just described, he'd done. Because he said, oh, I wanted a starter. I didn't have one. Roxanne doesn't have one. Nobody has one. So he grew his own. And it's like took a week, right, or more. And he not only gave me starter, but he gave Roxanne starters, and he gave Jen a starter. And I don't know, is there anybody else? Okay, you can have one too. Yeah, because, starter for everyone. This is why. When you feed the starter, it grows. It's kind of like, did you ever see the movie The Blob? It creeps and leaks across the floor. Anyway, it's really, it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, I had a very old book on sourdough, and so using the wisdom of the ages, I've been keeping my starter in the refrigerator, so everything's under control. However, I understand that James, Roxanne, and Jen are keeping their starters out at room temperature. So it's growing and growing and growing, and they have a lot of starter. Roxanne has been baking like crazy, and in her spare time, she's running up and down her street trying to give away starter to the neighbors. And I hear that Jen's trying to bake all hers. She's trying to use it, you know. Some of the recipes say, throw it away. And I'm like, I'm not throwing my starter away. I guess that's how she feels, too. So everyone's getting a lot of amazing bread, pancakes, and waffles. And I'm using it to, like, exercise hospitality with my students. On Friday morning, I had some PhD students over for sourdough waffles and fig and raisin bread. It's like, and it's cool, you know, but it's like it's a member of the family, right? So through the ages, people have really valued their starters. And not all starters are alike. The mold bacteria in San Francisco is particularly amazing, right? The best. And so Boudin Bakery in San Francisco has kept the same starter alive since 1849. You think, oh no, can that be good? It is good though. And that's 170 years. So first of all, I'm going to take a long shot at this and say, what does yeast have to do with feast? Because I'm talking about yeast, feast, and betrayal. And a little more bit of background before we get right to our story. Yeast is something about the phenomenal dynamics of food and relationships, and it gives us a peek at what part yeast would have played in the daily life of the first century. So if you make sourdough, it's going to be a key part of almost any feast you put on, right? Now you're going to say, yeah, next potluck, I'm going to bring something made of sourdough. And I've got all kinds of things in my book. I mean, you can make casseroles and encased in sourdough crusts and all this. I've got the best book. I'll let you look at it. I didn't bring it, though. I should have. And I think I've given a mini illustration, actually, on how food and what we call table fellowship creates communities on all kinds of levels, because we end up talking about it and trading things off. And when Roxanne called the other night, we had a big talk, right? And it's fun, and it makes a connection. It creates community. There are many recent studies on food, meals, and feasts in the Bible. And that the conclusion of these studies is that eating together, and I think preparation of food together as well, is worship. It's worship. It's not just a part of what we do as a church. It in itself is treated as worship. It was in the Old Testament, and it is in the New Testament. And in the Gospel of Mark, before you get to this discussion of the Last Supper, you know, that's what we call it. We call it the Last Supper, where Jesus eats Passover with his disciples. Meals are an important part of Jesus' strategy. And Jesus used them to challenge the culture's social and religious practices. I mean, he was running all over the boundaries constantly because they were places that reinforced status with special class distinctions, places to sit, and religious exclusion. Throughout Mark, Jesus has been crashing through all these boundaries. He ate with everybody, and he taught his disciples to do the same thing. Those who follow Jesus's example as well as his commands experience friendship, intimacy, and unity with people that are comparable to, at that time, tax collectors, sinners, the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Basically, this represents either people who need the grace of God because their life has failed in some sense, or they can't repay you. They're needy people. They can't give you the same thing. So this has everything to do with the nature of the gospel and the program of the kingdom, let alone that when we eat together as a community, we create unity and intimacy and friendship. And we strengthen those bonds. So we want to treat our meals together as sacred because it's actually taught in the Bible all through it. And we miss that. But here's the deal. Our passage is not about an everyday meal that the people of God are sharing. Our passage is about how Jesus and the disciples celebrated the main Jewish feast of the year, which is Passover. But you see that Mark calls Passover the feast of the unleavened bread. It's the feast that you don't use yeast. What is going on here? And so I'm going to give you some background, quite a bit of background on the Passover. The Lord, now I'm going to go to Exodus 12, 1. And so the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month will be the first month. It will be the first month of the year for you. Tell the whole Israelite community, on the 10th day of this month, they must take a lamb for each household, a lamb per house. If a household is too small for a lamb, it should share one with a neighbor nearby. You should divide the lamb in proportion to the number of people who will be eating it." Women know this, right? "Your lamb should be a flawless year-old male. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You should keep close watch over it until the 14th day of this month. At twilight on that day, the whole assembled Israelite community should slaughter their lambs. They should take some of the blood and smear it on the two doorposts and the beam over the door of the houses in which they are eating. That same night, they should eat the meat roasted over the fire. They should eat it along with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Don't eat any raw or boiled in water, but roasted fire with its head, legs, and internal organs. Don't let any of it remain till morning and burn any of it left in the morning. This is how you should eat it. You should be dressed with your sandals on your feet and your walking stick in your hand. You should eat the meal in a hurry. It is the Passover of the Lord. I'll pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and I'll strike down every oldest child in the land of Egypt, both human and animals. I'll impose judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be on your sign and on the houses where you live." Whenever I see the blood, I'll pass over you. No plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Now this is the part that this is all important, but this day will be a day of remembering for you. Oh, and I love that. A day of remembering. You will observe it as a festival to the Lord. You will observe it in every generation as a regulation for all time. You will eat unleavened bread for 7 days. On the first day, you must remove yeast from your houses, because anyone who eats unleavened bread any time during those 7 days will be cut off from Israel. I'll read that again. You will eat unleavened bread for 7 days. On the first day, you must remove yeast from your houses, because anyone who eats unleavened bread any time during those 7 days will be cut off from Israel. Well, San Francisco would mourn this. The first day and seventh day will be a holy occasion for you. No work at all should be done on these days except for preparing the food that everyone is going to eat. That is the only work you may do. You should observe the festival of unleavened bread, because on this precise day, I brought you out of the land of Egypt in military formation. You should observe this day in every generation as a regulation for all time. In the first month, from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day, you should eat unleavened bread. If you missed that point, they repeat it, right? For 7 days, no yeast should be found in your house, because whoever eats unleavened bread will be cut off from the Israelite community, whether the person is an immigrant or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything made with yeast in all your settlements. You should eat only unleavened bread. Well, how interesting is that? In the first Passover, what do you know why they had unleavened bread? They had unleavened bread because there was no time to let the bread rise. Remember that 13 to 17 hour period in a woman's routine every day? That got completely disrupted during the Passover. So they had to eat, and there might have been yeast in the bread, but it had no time. They had to eat that without proofing it, which is really actually not great. Actually, they had to eat it without proofing it. And so notice that the whole Passover lasts a week. That is, you have to eat unleavened bread for a week. And I've been thinking about this, and I realize, aha, that's exactly the time it takes to make a starter. So the Israelites would have not had, in the beginning, for a week, they'd have no yeast in their bread, because they lost it all. They lost their starter when they left. And so they're reenacting what happened to them. And see how much emphasis is placed on this thing. And why do they place emphasis on this thing? I think because yeast is actually a really important part of the day and the routine of food preparation, and it really dominates the life of the people who are making the bread. It really, truly does. And so it's very common for scholars and preachers to say that all this focus is on yeast is because it's sin. And well, anyone can see that yeast is a great metaphor, right? It's like a little bit of yeast is going to keep growing and growing until it takes over your life, you know? And so this is a great metaphor. But is this sin? I think not. That would be crazy, because it's like I said, it's something that is a part and parcel of cooking. I think it's an exercise in missing the point of what's really going on and actually not really understanding the rhythms of life. So perhaps that's what happens. That is what happens when women have no input into biblical interpretation and theology, right? The women who are using the yeast actually would get this. It was men start dominating and don't listen to the voices of women, and you can miss the point when they're talking about things that dominate women's lives. So when the disciples asked Jesus about where he wanted them to go and make preparations for the Passover, you can see that preparations were a much bigger deal than usual. I mean, I was like, 17 hours of working on breads, one preparation, but preparation for the Passover, oh my. And they started too late, I can tell you that, because I looked online and I saw this 10 easy steps for the Passover, and one of those easy steps was clean your whole house. And why don't you rotate your clothes out while you do it? So in the traditional preparation, I think we've added a few things, but not a lot of things when you look at how people, most of the things that are celebrated in the Passover Seder are constant since the first century and before that. So you not only slaughter and roast the lamb and, you know, paint the blood on your door, but you have to remove all the yeast from your house where you celebrate. And of course, in time and tradition, this became quite elaborate. And so this turns out to be house cleaning on steroids. And you're supposed to start a week ahead of time, and you go through everything. And dust counts because, you know, yeast and bread make crumbs and dust. So you're going over all the cracks in the house. And so on the last day, the tradition is to go over your house with a candle, a feather, and a spoon to find every last piece of shemetz. Anything fermented with wheat, the bread, the crumbs, the starters, you all throw it out. And this includes your chocolate for some reason. You have to throw out all your chocolate. So there are a lot of other preparations as well that don't even have to do with yeast, but you have to make six, besides a full meal, in this case it would be a full meal for 16 people, and it's a feast because it's a big deal, you have to have six food items with ritual plates or bowls. So I actually have put on a couple of seders, and it takes a lot of time and attention to get this thing ready so you have everything that works right. And of course, this is like a big deal. You want to do it right. So this is a very big statement for someone about a feast, and it would have changed my entire basic life routine for about a month, doing this kind of thing if you do it right. Now I think it necessarily doesn't, because you can go to the store and says, okay, now you've got to prepare your Passover bread. So you go to the store and you buy your stuff and you buy your matzah and all that. Well, you had to make it. And so it was much more life controlling. I think it's really interesting now, or get more into our passage, that Mark makes a point that Jesus is the one who already made complex preparations. And it seems to me that he's enlisted a lot of people into preparing for the Passover. And so the disciples, on the day of that they're supposed to, you know, sacrifice the lamb, they said, "You want us to get everything ready?" And I'm like, "Are you stupid? You think you're going to do this in one day?" And Jesus has already planned everything out. And he has this little, but this is what's curious, right? It almost looks like it's an undercover operation, right? Like you go into the city and you find a guy with a jar and you say this, you know, you say a secret code and then you follow him in. Did that ever strike you as odd? You say, okay, that's probably one of the things where you say, I'm divine and everything and I know everything, so I know there's going to be a guy with a water jar. You say, no, actually, I think that this was something that you can see why it's happening in the context. You see in verse 14:1 that the chief priests and teachers of the law were trying to find a sly way to arrest and kill him. And you see in 14:10 that Judas Iscariot had contacted them to betray him. He wasn't only trying to, you know, mislead the rabbis and the Pharisees. He had to trick Judas for them to actually get through this thing. Yeah, and this is the first time this occurred to me, is that it was all obscure and everything, so Judas wouldn't betray him before they'd gone through the ceremony, because if they all knew where he was and they didn't go through the secret, you know, the secret operation, things would have ended sooner. And I think Jesus had a plan of what he wanted to do, right? Clearly. He was going to do something extremely important. He didn't want an interruption. So this is really interesting to me. And so in the Passover, the Jews personally reenact and relive what happened in the Exodus with Moses. That is, when God visited the plagues on Egypt, and they ate that Passover meal, when they sacrificed the lamb and painted the blood on the doorstep, that was so the angel of death would pass over them. Because God said the angel of death is going to come in and kill all the firstborn people in Israel. If you don't have this done, that will be you. Your house will also lose all the firstborns. And so this reenacts all the thing, and personally reenacts through the whole ceremony. They're going over the Exodus and all this detail about what happened. And then they said, this happened to me. This happened to me. And later on in the Bible, all the way through, they say, when you see a stranger in the land or the poor, you be kind to them and you take care of them, you treat them well, because you were a stranger. It was me, I was there. And if I didn't, you know, if it doesn't seem like a big deal to me, you reenact it every single year. So they have done it, the Jews have done it every year since the Exodus when they left Egypt with Moses. And so when Jesus and his disciples celebrated it, they were taking part in a ceremony that Jews claimed to have done for 2,000 years, more or less, at that point. I mean, almost exactly 2,000 years. The traditions were pretty standardized by Jesus' time, so we have a very good idea of how they did it, because we have a script on the Seder called the Haggadah, which is very, very early. I was going to read you a description of the Passover that Gamaliel had given, who was a contemporary of Jesus. He was Paul's teacher, but I left it back in my bag, I think, and that's okay. And what it is he talks about how important each of the aspects of the Seder are and what they mean. And he makes the point, because it's like you were there. You become there by going through this. We can tell, you know, how the elements of the communion in Jesus' Last Supper fit into the Seder ceremony. Because there is a very special ceremony with a piece of the Passover bread. It's called the afikomen. It's the matzah that's literally broken and a cup of wine that is drunk at that time. So before the meal, you have three pieces of matzah and they're wrapped in a large napkin. In a kind of, I think they're kind of layered in like this, and that it should be one is important. At one point in the meal, you take out the middle piece, what they call the afikomen, and the afikomen is a big deal and a big point. You break it, and then you go and hide it a piece. If you have children, they're going to have kind of like an Easter egg hunt afterwards where they're going to find the afikomen. And at the end of the meal, after you've finished everything, they call this the dessert, which kind of bugs me because it's really not that great, right? Because it's unleavened with no salt, but it's dessert. It's the last thing you eat other than two more glasses of wine. So everyone takes a piece of this afikomen, and they said at least has to be the size of an olive, right? So you got to be sure it's there. And you can't eat anything more for the rest of the night. That is it for you. And this is, you know, very important. And so some Jews believe that it symbolizes the ultimate redemption from suffering. The ultimate redemption from suffering. And some see it as standing for the Passover sacrifice itself. Either way, right? So Jesus takes this piece of bread. It's clear it's this one. And he says, he breaks it, and says, take it, this is my body. He's taking something that people have been doing for 2,000 years, and it has all this meaning, and everyone's always discussing it. And he's going, this thing we've been doing for 2,000 years, this is my body. Bible scholars debate about the idea of Christ's death being redemption started. They say that had to be late, but it's all right here. It's all right here. All you have to do is exegete the Seder, and you actually get it. The church, and John has him saying, behold the Lamb of God, if you missed that, from the communion service. The church has debated about whether this statement means the bread becomes the body of Christ. But if you understand the background, you'll understand that there's a referent. And it's this afikomen, it's the afikomen that you've been celebrating every year for 2,000 years. This is my body. And now the cup of wine that Jesus picks up, That's got to be the third cup of wine that they drink in the ceremony. Yeah, everybody has to drink four cups of wine. It's kind of an interesting night, right? And it's like a rule. You're supposed to drink the entire cup. This is the third cup. And Jews call it the cup of redemption. The first cup is called sanctification. The second cup is called the cup of plagues. I really like that one, incidentally. Because in the cup of plagues, you go through the 10 plagues and you pour out a drop and you say, if you had stopped with the first plague, it would have been enough. If you stopped with the second plague, it would have been enough. And I'm like, oh, that is so great for gratitude. What a great practice for gratitude. So sanctification, cup of plagues, and the third cup is called the cup of redemption or the cup of blessing. And the fourth cup is called the cup of praise. So Jesus takes the cup of redemption. Again, just exegete the Passover service. You'll understand that Jesus was saying he was redemption. He was providing redemption. And he said, this is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. And then this is weird. And you didn't realize this, did you? He said, truly, I tell you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. What's wrong with that? If you know the background, they never finished the Seder. And actually, it's like you got to do it. You drink all four cups. And so he stopped the Seder before it was done, said, I'm done. And so it was like this unfinished story. And Mark kind of does this. I could spend some time talking about other places, one of them being the ending of Mark. And that's too complex for me to talk about right now. But it's like having a dangling modifier or something. Mark kind of leaves you hanging. And this Passover Seder, Jesus leaves you hanging. We've got a missing cup. They never drank the fourth. And actually, I was reading over the ceremony. What he says is, did I say what he said? Yeah, I won't drink of the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. And I think there's different ideas about how this worked out, but I think it fits very well with the worship and revelation in the marriage of the Lamb. He said, that's when we drink the fourth cup. And so this is less this long gap, long gap in the Passover, and there's an unfinished story. So three things at this point I want to highlight that I hope you've picked up, or at least when I make them, I think you'll recognize them. First, meals together are worship. Their gospel, their kingdom, they're sacred. All our meals together are sacred, are worship. Second, most of you know that this passage is the basis of communion. And throughout the Bible, in the few references to it, they make it obvious that this ceremony continued to be part of the meal in the early church, although they didn't restrict it to the Passover service once a year. They tended to do it a lot, but it was always continued to be part of a meal. Third, the meaning and practice of communion, as practiced by the early church, is completely embedded in the Jewish Passover. So you all got that, right? With my point that I made, that actually fits what I've talked to you about. Well, so we have yeast and we have feast. And now let's talk about the betrayal in the passage, because I kind of skipped over that when I was talking about what happened here. Mark has laced a dark theme of betrayal through this very important story, this story that like explains something that Christians have been doing to worship ever since, practicing communion or the Eucharist. Jesus was sending a message throughout his ministry about meals. But the disciples, particularly Mark, were growing in their inability to understand Jesus and his mission. And I could say something about the previous passage as being a big problem when the woman, you know, anointed him with that expensive perfume and broke that container of alabaster over him. They were furious. And he goes, stop bothering the women. She's done a wonderful thing for me. And they were like, they just didn't get it. They didn't get it. So this was so here we have, right after that in the account, them having this incredibly intimate, secret, and supposedly safe celebration, an enactment of their unity, I already said intimacy, friendship, and something else. I don't know. I can't remember. Intimacy and friendship, anyway, is part of meals. But this is even a bigger thing. It's the unity of their origin as the people of God and freedom expressed in their intimacy of sharing food. Well, one of everybody thought, not just Jews, that you can't betray or be unfaithful to anyone at the shared table. When you have a meal with someone, that creates a bond or an obligation. And it was at this most important meal in the Jewish calendar that Jesus says in the middle of the meal, someone who is eating with me is going to betray me. It's one of the 12. One who actually dips his bread in the bowl with me. Can you conceive of it? And at this point, it's like, what? No! The fact that this happened at this time, in this setting, really, really brings home the enormity of what Jesus is doing. It's not only what he's doing, and we all got that, I think. It's the timing. Outrageous. Jesus said, really, one of the worst things he's ever said about anybody, it would be better if he had never been born than he'd done this. And then it really gets worse. After the meal, Jesus tells them, you're all going to fall away. And in a sense, they're going to follow Judas instead of follow Jesus. Scott Barthy said that for Mark, the Last Supper is a climactic last meal at which discipleship collapses completely. Wow. But Peter is so sure of himself. Now, a lot of people laugh at, I'm glad he didn't laugh, because I'm tired of people laughing at Peter. They laugh at Peter like, what an idiot he is. I wouldn't do that. That's kind of Peter's attitude too, though. It's exactly what he's doing here. He goes, ha, 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 all these guys, you know, they may do that. But I would never do that. And Jesus nailed him. He said, yes, you will. Today, before the rooster crows twice, you will. And another man called Ralph Gorman said, in spite of all his forecasts and warnings, in spite of all his efforts to prepare them in advance, the apostles refused to face the facts. And the awful reality of Christ's suffering and death swept over them with the suddenness and completeness of a tidal wave. And, you know, that's a good one, right? You know, no one expects the tidal wave when you're on the beach, really. Well, Jesus prophesied about the desertion, but he also prophesied about their reconciliation in Galilee. Scholars talk a lot about why Mark is so hard on the disciples, because he really is much harder than any of the others, especially, you know, most people think Mark wrote first and the others had read him, and Matthew is so much nicer in contrast, like he cleans it up. Now, why is Mark so hard? And this is a bit of a discussion, but I actually believe that he was humanizing them and showing that our Christian life is really lived in reality. It is the reality of tsunamis. Tsunamis happen. And famines happen, and disasters happen, and sometimes Christians tell themselves the story that if you really have enough faith, life's not going to have a tsunami. Well, I see Scripture telling quite a different story, quite a different story. And Christian life is lived in this kind of the same reality that everybody else is living in. And if we know ourselves, we should know that we're capable of behaving in the same way with exactly the same weaknesses as you see in Peter and the other disciples. We can fail to face facts. We can overestimate our own performance. We can overestimate our value. The good news is that Jesus came for people like me who are going to screw up. But he's still going to meet me in Galilee if I'm willing to take the humble role of the prodigal son and come back to him. So there's three things I want to highlight for you, and I think mostly it's a knowing goal, a knowing application. First of all our meals together are worship. Guess who's coming to dinner last night was worship. And the Wallaces and I had dinner with Bernadette and Rupert, who hosted us, and it was holy. It was holy ground. The meals together are gospel. They are kingdom. Let's think of them as sacred, treat them as sacred, and practice them as sacred. I mean, they can become profane if you treat them as that. But I think if even we don't know what's happening, that things are happening to us when we meet together, even if we don't understand it. If we understand it, how much better? Second, most of you know that this passage is the basis of communion, and communion continued to be practiced as a part of meals, real meals, in the early church. And one of the things, and this is not something I talk about over and over and over again, is I continually challenge in my teaching and preaching that there's a problem with the way we celebrate communion. We get these little wafers in this little cup, and we say, this is like it means the same thing. And it's kind of abstract. It's like all symbolic. This symbolizes bread, and this symbolizes a cup of wine. And we kind of are faking it. We claim, this is really meaningful. This is really meaningful. Isn't it meaningful? We claim it means the same thing. Does it mean the same thing when you change the form? I suggest, given the sacredness of meals, by turning it into a ritual rather than part of a real meal, we actually aren't getting it very well. And you can talk to people that say, yeah, I practice communion, but it doesn't mean anything. Well, I'm teaching a class right now called Devotional Practices in the Early Church. And I was like, so good. You know, I love this. And so what I did is I had the class over for 2 weeks. And the first week we just did table fellowship. And one of the guys said, communion's never meant anything. Now, this is a seminary student. Communion has never meant anything to me. But after we're in this intimate, and it's so funny, the class morphed into being something totally different than what it was. Immediately, when they came to my house and we shared a meal together, all of a sudden, all the dynamics changed. And we got to the communion, and it was funny because it was both formal and informal. It's like we made a few jokes and laughed while we were passing it around. Instead of being real, oh, I wouldn't pass this plate. I'm not going to look at you. You know, this real informal thing. It was actually part of the meal, and it reflected our relationship, and it was sacred and holy, much more so. And that's what he said, never meant anything until I had it that night, and then everything changed. But I don't think it's necessarily going to be meaningful when he goes back to the, you know, to the ritual way. I said, this is meaningful. This was not meaningful. I hear that over and over again. I said, so consider practicing communion as a church, as a part of table fellowship, because I think when you change the form, you change the meaning. That's my opinion. Okay, it's out there. I've said it before. It's not the first time. Okay. Third, the meaning and practice of communion in the Gospels is fully embedded in the Jewish Passover. I've only scratched the surface. I've said some important things, because the thing about the afikoman and the cup is a big deal. But, I mean, the stuff, the parts of the ceremony around that are so very cool. I urge you, you'll never get to the bottom of this, but I urge you to try. You can look it up online. This is a profound ceremony in which the grace and salvation from God is enacted. It's the first passion play. Get into it. Try to attend a Seder maybe this Easter season. They have Messianic Seders. They're wonderful, where they actually explain how the different parts of the Seder are related to the New Testament and the life and person of Christ. And it's phenomenal. So the second thing we did is have a Seder at the house. Even though it wasn't Easter, we went ahead and enacted a Seder. And only one of the other people had actually done that before. I was quite shocked, actually. Because to me, it seems like the most normal and natural thing to do. I don't do it every year, but I do it from time to time. Finally, hearing the story and celebrating communion is a time to face the facts and get real about ourselves. right? That's the doing part. I mean, I think that I could actually try to squeeze doing into the other two things. It's not all about knowing. But the thing is, you know, you relate to the disciples and say they needed to face the facts and they needed to get real. And we need to get real about how we're treating our brothers and sisters at communion. One of the things I really have a problem with the ritualistic communion is we isolate and we think about ourselves and God, but communion is actually a community. It's a community thing, and then when in 1 Corinthians 11, when Paul's talking about it, he's talking about how bizarrely everybody was behaving to each other in communion. He's like going, this is so opposite of what's supposed to happen at this meal, and he gives instructions about how you conduct yourself at a meal. And then he says you ought to examine yourself before you eat the bread and cup. Not that you go into your prayer closet, navel gaze, but you really think about how you are behaving with your brothers and sisters when you gather together and what's inconsistent with this communion ceremony. And so those are the applications, those are the things and applications that I wanted to leave you with. I hope it didn't seem too random. I talked a lot about yeast, but I think that's interesting because, yeah, yeast here in the unleavened bread, it's not about sin. It's about examination. It's about having the whole routine of your life, you know, ripped out from under you. And it's about you can't save your starter for 170 years. And that's too bad, right? I look at that and say, you know, right? You go, it's already a member of the family, and then you're going to take it out and burn it? I don't think so! You know, no, but if you were Jewish, you'd say, oh, it's unbelievable that you would actually take something that's so important, such a part of your daily routine, and throw it out. But it's radical. So sometimes following the gospel and following Jesus is radical and it's costly. And this is true. This isn't about sin. This is about costly. This is about 7 more days of work before you even start being able to do bread again. That's why you can't eat bread for a week. Yeast bread for a week. So this is that's why I spent so much time on yeast, because I think we'd have some fun with it. And I thought we'd all, especially the ones who've been around it, would kind of relate to this thing. It's like, yeah, things were different back then. You just didn't throw out your yeast and go to the store and buy a new loaf. It was a big deal. And so we just got to let Jesus be a big deal. We got to face the facts and we got to be real about ourselves. That's why these stories are so great.